Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Rugby League Digest. I'm Michael Adams, here with Andrew Paskin. How's it going, Andy?
Good, mate. How are you going?
I'm good. I've been steeped in English rugby league for the last month or so. I apologise to the listeners for the delay in getting the next Super League chapter out to you, but this has been a really tough one to put together. So our next chapter does focus on the English side of the Super League war. I've had to rope in some help on that. And so tonight is a little preamble to that chapter. And some of the help I've drawn on is Mike Mehall-Wood, who joins us tonight to talk about the 1996 Challenge Cup final. He's really burst onto the scene in terms of rugby league journalism in Australia. I've loved reading his articles over the last couple of months. So, Mike, very happy to have you with us.
Welcome, yeah, mate.
It's great. I love the podcast. This is exactly the level of nerd that I like to go into. So I'm sure I'll be in good company. I hope you can put up with me talking at depth at a game that happened when I was seven. So,
Well, you really speak to us with your nerddom. That's why we've got you here tonight. I wanted to maybe just give our listeners a bit of an introduction to you. As I said, you've been doing some great stuff on Forbes, looking at rugby league and other sports, taking a broader view of the game, a lot of the business of rugby league, and it's a very like game first approach to rugby league, and I've loved getting that perspective. So can you just give us a bit of an introduction to where you come in on rugby league and where you come in on your journalism?
Yeah, so I mean as you can tell probably from the next hour or so of content, I've watched rugby league since I was a little child. You know, the earliest I can remember is probably 94-95 season in the UK. I definitely remember the 95 World Cup and then obviously the start of Super League. So I've been watching this my whole life. I'm from Rochdale, which is kind of heartlands of rugby league, just north of Manchester. But I've only really been writing about it for Forbes. I started working for Forbes in 2018, I think. Mostly doing soccer because I was based in Germany at the time. But obviously, the more they let me write about whatever I wanted to write about, the more I started writing about rugby league. So I'd been doing a bit before. I did podcasts and stuff like that on the Super League. I actually used to work at the RFL as a sort of student, kind of you know, making brews and working in the ticket office in the summer. So I kind of worked at a lot of levels. My dad's a rugby league development officer in the UK, so he'll be mentioned frequently in this. A lot of people in the UK rugby league scene sort of would know who he was, though he's not particularly famous. It's that sort of strange. Dichotomy. But yeah, so what I try and do is, I mean, the column I do is I've invented my own brand of the NRL outsider, which is sort of looking at the NRL from an outsider's perspective, because whilst I'm sort of as rugby league as they come, obviously I'm not Australian, I only moved here in January, so I'm not you know, I feel like I have the authority currently at the moment to look at things from the outside. And sort of as long as I've been a journalist, my career has like walked hand in hand with working in marketing. So most recently I was doing, you know, I was working on the global advertising campaigns for Tommy Hilfiger, Calvin Klein. Before that I was working at Polaroid and Puma and loads of other different brands sort of within that space. So I do know, I like to think a little bit about marketing and how, you know, it works on a much bigger level than rugby league, you know. So I try and bring a little bit of that to it. And obviously the good thing about working for Forbes is that that's what they want. You know, they want you to look at things in a business angle because that's kind of their USP. So they have a very hands-off editorial policy, thankfully, where you just get to write about whatever you want. So I've been trying to just point out things that I've always, either that I've thought for years or that I've noticed since I've been here. And you ask Australians and they sort of go, well, it's always been like that. Well, my job as the outsider is to point out the things that everybody says have always been like that and be like, why?
Would you like a job as the chief executive officer of the NRL? Or because we need you.
Yeah, well, I actually had some meetings with people in Super League because I wrote similar columns about Super League. If you scroll down, you can find stuff I wrote about Super League that was very similar. And I did speak to people about it, but it's very easy to sit and write it and very difficult to make it happen when you've got to, you know, make ends meet and you've got loads of stakeholders. It's great for me going, why don't you just play more international games? And they go, well, can you try and sell that one to 16 club owners who pay salaries, blah, blah, blah. So there is an element of, you know, realism that I can understand. That's just the way the world works. But yeah, if you don't ask the question, you don't get out, do you? So
how familiar were you with the nitty-gritty of Australian rugby league before you moved out here?
Well, pretty. I mean, I worked predominantly for Australian clients. So I used to work for Steve Mascod's rugby league hub going back to 2017 or 2018. I covered the NRL pretty much week to week. I always use this anecdote. I think I've used it in a column before, but we used to get like a porn video club where it was Winfield Cup highlights, where there was a company in Wigan that would like duplicate the tapes of the Winfield Cup and send it out to newsagents so you could subscribe to it. So all the way through the 90s, we had, you know, Winfield Cup games and State of Origin and stuff like that. And obviously we played the Kangaroo Tours. And so I was well aware of, you know, who the figures are. It's been interesting because the whole Super League War stuff that you've been covering, I know nothing about, because I was, at the time it was like, wow, the colours. Hunter Mariners, look at that jersey, that looks great. So I wonder where Hunter is, you know. To me, Hunter Mariners sounds like someone's name, like didn't he play second row for Salford, Hunter Mariner? And so yeah, it's been illuminating listening to this, because it's sort of, you know, I know the figures, but like I know who Ken Arfison is, but I don't know anything about him really. I've got no context. So yeah, it's been super interesting, especially with you guys going absolutely in depth now. I feel like I'll sound like a more intelligent journalist when people ask me questions about it. Super League in the UK was not, in my experience, as bad an idea as it was in the NRL or in the ARL, sorry, because it just needed to happen. Something needed to happen to give the game a kick up the ass. I mean, you know, you can just go and look. As a business journalist, I go, well, go look at the TV figures, go look at the attendance figures, go look at the fact that Bradford didn't have any women's toilets. Like,
it's worse than Leichhardt, Mick.
I was going to say, speaking of which, you've been on a little tour of all our rugby league grounds, you know, since the season started. Have you made your way to Leichhardt yet?
No, I went on the day at Leichhardt, they played at Leichhardt. I went to North Sydney Oval, then to Bank West on the same day. But I have been to Cogra Oval. Good bugs, solid bugs. Look like they've been there a long time.
The west side's good, the east side not so much.
You can see the sea from the press box, I'll give it that. And so I don't like in the press box here, you've got like, it's always behind glass, which really annoys me. So I go, and because I'm not covering the match minute by minute, you know, I'm just sort of getting general feel for the place, I usually go and stand on the hill after a bit. I like to go and have stick, you know, a couple of free pies and then go somewhere else. But yeah, it's been good. I'm thinking next year I might try and do Leagues clubs. Just try and go to every Leagues club.
That'd be awful.
Yeah, it sounds like hell on earth. I mean, I don't know. It's still impressive to me that there's like a big thing that's called a Leagues club. I'm still like, wow, imagine if, you know, Batley Bulldogs had one of these.
Yeah, basically, if you've ever seen a picture of the Taj Mahal, that's the vibe we have gone for and succeeded in recreating.
It's more a gambling den. It'd be like calling a Scottish smack house a social club.
Well, if you notice, the game that we're talking about is in the grand tradition is the Silk Cut Challenge Cup, which was a fag brand. And spoiler alert, Robbie Ball gets given $10,000 by a fag company at the end of the game.
I was going to bring that up myself, but I mean, like, his reaction to that was so funny. It was just so low key.
They say to him, he goes, you know, I'm devastated. I can't really talk about it. And then the interviewer, who in the grand tradition of rugby league names is called Dickie Duckinfield. I'm convinced is actually, you know, like in Mad Men, when it turns out, spoiler alert again, in Mad Men, Don Draper's not actually called Don Draper. I think that's Dave Woods, who does the BBC now. But he's like, he lived under the name Dick Duckinfield until about 2000. He's got exactly the same voice. They got him on the touchline.
All right, well, let's try to steer this back on track somehow and go to the game itself. So the 1996 Challenge Cup final, this game means a lot to you. You've given us this beautiful dossier. It's usually my job doing the dossiers, so to be presented with such a thorough document that I'm looking at now, it's a real treat for me. one of the great games as well. I think anyone who hasn't watched it, stop listening to this now. Go and find it on YouTube, watch the game, then come back to us. But can you just set it up? Why this game? Why did you want to talk about this game?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the podcast series has been about Super League and how it started. So this game was 6 weeks after the start of Super League in the UK. So it was April the 23rd, 1996. We'd had the first game, which was Paris against Sheffield, was, I think, the end of February in Paris. So this is all very much the new era has begun. So you're watching Bradford Bulls, who were called Bradford Northern or Bradford Northern, if you're actually from Bradford, who had changed their name. They were the absolute poster boys of Super League. So they had a guy called Peter Deakin, who was the sort of CEO, chief executive. But he was the first person to do sort of the NFLization, as I've called it, of the game. So you went to Bradford, they had the big mascot. Every week was like a theme night. I used to go to Bradford pretty much every week because I'm actually a Hull FC supporter, but it's too far away from my house to drive to Hull every week. So we used to go to Bradford. Also, Brian Smith, he's a coach, as we'll come on to. He's a mate of my dad's for a very convoluted reason. So we quite like them. But then it's St. Helens who... my parents used to live in St. Helens. My dad was a teacher there. They actually got married. Well, I got married in a church, but their wedding reception was in the Saints Leaf Club, like the social club in the stadium. My mum got quite emotional when they closed the stadium down a couple of years ago. And also because Wigan had won it for 8 years in a row. You know, this was the end of the Wigan dynasty. And I actually remember watching live on Saturday afternoon, watching Salford, who were the champions of the second division, beat Wigan. And you can watch that game on YouTube as well. It's pretty entertaining. If you want to see what rugby league looked like before Super League, that's about 2 weeks before Super League started, I think, and it's pretty grim looking. You know, there's the context, is you've got the era of Wigan is over. This is the new era. It's bright. It's a sunny afternoon. They're wearing sort of, you know, it's weird because Bradford's kit looks like a Super League kit. They've got squad numbers on the back, which actually went and watched the semi-final today, and they didn't have squad numbers, and every player just had Bulls written in the same font above the number, which is very unusual. So, you know, this is the new era. This is kind of what we're trying to get at. And I think it's important to think of it in the context as well, because so this was 3 weeks after the greatest game in the history of the Premier League football, which is Liverpool 4, Newcastle 3. Well worth looking up as well. And, you know, it's just before England was going to host the European Football Championship. The Tory government that had ruined everything, they were very much on their last legs. So they've got this kind of, you know, this cultural moment that a lot of people in Britain would say was about to happen with Britpop the year before and sort of what was later referred to very cringeworthy as Cool Britannia. So it kind of fits into this sort of place in my head, you know, and I'm sure... I'm told by the notes that Andy wants to talk about Oasis. So.
love Oasis, mate. But like you said, you're from Rochdale. Do you support the Hornets or just...
So there'll be some high-quality Rochdale Hornets content planned in for later when we have to talk about Bobby Gilding, who was a club legend of Rochdale. And I say that in sort of both ironic and non-ironic terms. I am a Rochdale Hornets fan. I watched them pretty much every week when I was growing up. I mean, the first game I ever went to, I think, was Rochdale Hornets against Carlisle in 1994. And I was a ball boy all through my childhood, so I went almost every week that they played at home.
Awesome.
I've seen some interesting sights there at Rochdale Hornets, I'll tell you what. It's an unusual rugby league club. But I should plug my own work, because I've just written an article about their connection to BG, which is one of the most unusual things in rugby league, and people should go and read it, because it's a very strange style.
I can't recommend your work enough. I use Forbes as a resource in my work all the time in general, but reading your stuff, I know you feel like a modern journalist and I love it. So get out and check out Mike's work, everybody.
Probably the biggest divide in Andy and I's relationship is the fact that I'm a Blur guy. So can you settle the debate for us? Break the tie? Yeah,
the best band of the Britpop era are Pulp.
Oh, so. I love Pulp too.
Yeah, Oasis are better than Blur, but Pulp are better than all of them. That's the short answer.
I like Jarvis too, but I mean, once you get past Common People, it's a bit of a quality drop-off.
Oh, absolutely nonsense. Absolutely. They did an eight-minute-long song called Sheffield Sex City about wanting to go and shag someone on the other side of town, but you couldn't go because the bus fares go up at 7. Salt of the Earth. That's, you know, write about what you know, write about the people that you see.
Yeah, his lyrics are phenomenal. Like, his interviews in the documentary Live Forever are some of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. He's sitting in this, like, boarding house on a single bed, and he's just so sardonic, Jarvis Cocker.
Yeah. He's I think his dad actually lives in Australia now, but yeah, he's I would say they're probably in my top five favorite bands of all time, are Pulse. And I actually think they get better. Most people think they peaked around 96, which is Common People. I think actually got better as they before they stopped in 2000.
I think it's the perfect song. I listen to it probably 5-10 times a week, no joke.
What, Common People?
Yeah, I love it. I think it's one of the most perfect songs ever written.
Yeah, there's a good Nick Cave cover of it as well. I would recommend looking up if you want an Australian twist on it.
Well, while we're on this topic, Mick, just quickly, I was just thinking about this Challenge Cup, what a major event it is, and how everyone goes down on the train and goes to Wembley, or back in the old days. And it was sort of like it's a northern game, but we're going down to London to have the big event and show off in front of them and get their approval. That's how it felt to me. Even though it was great, Wembley was great, it pissed me off that, like, they didn't care about rugby league all year until the big one. And then I just thought about how Manchester took over the music scene and with Manchester, and it was the centre of Britain there for a while. And I'd like to see the rugby league stay in the heartland, you know, and not bow to the southern fairies.
Have you ever been to a Challenge Cup final, either of you? Well, it is that kind of experience still does exist, where it's very funny, like, because mostly, obviously, everybody goes down in the morning. Often when it was in August, they're moving it back to July now, but when it was in August, they often was on a bank holiday, so you couldn't, the trains wouldn't be on. It was really annoying. Like, there was one year Warrington played, and you just couldn't get back to Warrington on the train, so the whole thing was destroyed. It used to be, when I was a kid, you used to go down and, like, all the clubs would run a bus, you know? Although, as we'll come on to, this was not, we have sort of a unique Challenge Cup final experience, where I think my parents have been to almost every one since, definitely since 85, which I think might have been the first one my mum went to. My dad's been to every one for about 50 years. But every year you go, you know, there's guys in fancy dress. And it's also because, like, there's that animosity in its rugby league people. Like, just treat London as, like, absolute shite the whole time. Like, just abuse people, drunk and obnoxious in the best possible, not in an aggressive way, but just a absolute don't give a shit about you or your fucking city kind of way. Which
just
I
just another way.
But very much appreciated. it's funny because you go to like some pub and it literally will just be like the closest pub to Euston Station. It'll just have, you know, 50 blokes from Dewsbury being obnoxious in it, and all these people sipping their fucking rosés going, what's going on here? What language are these people speaking?
But I posited in my addendum to your notes that, I don't know if you know Gavin Willacy at all, but I read an article that he did talking about the diminished profile of rugby league in the south. He grew up in Hertfordshire, so not like in the north, but he was saying in the 80s it was just like, it was kind of a niche sport still, but it was on the landscape. And you had, you know, in the early 90s, Martin Afire, Ellery Hanley being, you know, making the top 50 most well-paid English athletes and that sort of thing. And it just seems that by this point, by the mid-90s, that had all started to fall away. Like, there were no rugby league players cutting through at a national level. And it seems that maybe the Challenge Cup was a day for Northerners in the south. Like, do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, I mean, there's one big reason why that happened. For a podcast that talks about games breaking away from other games, like, the Premier League just blew everything out of the water in 1992. So, I mean, you say if Hanley and Afire were in the top 50 best paid sports people, it's because footballers weren't being paid well. So you look at, like, what the top earning player in the Super League earns now, and it's like what a Man City reserve earns in a week, and they earn it in a year. You can't imagine how much the landscape was changed by the Premier League and what you had in the early 90s. So the formation of the Premier League wasn't that much of a big deal in terms, obviously it was a big deal, but it wasn't like a generational shift. But then when you get the Man United teams that come through, certainly this is how it felt in Manchester. When you get the Man United team comes through, and then, I mean, so for example, this season we're talking about, you have Liverpool, Newcastle, Man United going for the title. This is the Man United team that first has Beckham in it. And I'm going to use my musical analogy. I always like the what was in the charts at the time. But Spice Girls Wannabe came out about 2 months after this, I think. So this is, you know, this whole cultural wave, which brings football with it. And Euro 96, which is like, you can't imagine how big an effect that had on football in terms of rehabilitating it from being the hooligan thing into being like a cool thing. You know, Oasis going on TV wearing their Man City shirts, stuff like that.
Yeah.
This 2 or 3 weeks after this was the Spice Boys final with where Man United beat Liverpool in the FA Cup final on my birthday, ruined my birthday. But yeah, so you can't imagine how big football was. And at the same time, English cricket was in a bit of a dull run. We were shit in the 90s. Rugby union obviously went professional as well, but still wasn't, you know, it was still very much league or union. And so union got that big boost from going professional. And football just ruled everything. Like it still does now. It still utterly dominates pretty much everything except for a couple of months in the summer when we get cricket. But mostly even then it's talking about the transfer window. Like it's difficult to imagine the cultural hegemony that football has. And I say that as someone who, you know, I love football. I'm a football journalist, like as well as a rugby league journalist. But it is difficult, like, to use the Forbes terminology, like rugby league is basically a heritage bespoke product that people will always love because it's different. It's kind of like an indie band compared to Ed Sheeran, whereas football is just so all consuming. You know, if you ask people to name 50 athletes in England, they'd probably get like Anthony Joshua, Tyson Fury, and probably 10 footballers. So that's just how it is. Like, that's why we compete in a different talent pool, different media environment, blah, 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 all of these things, because football's just so big. When you look at like Super League going onto Sky and behind a paywall, like the reason that Sky exists, probably the reason they even tried to buy out the Super League in Australia is because they made so much money buying out the Premier League. Like in England, that's where that's the cash cow, you know, and it still is to this day.
Well, it's such a good point, mate, because like Murdoch had Sky, right? And then made all that money from Premier League. And then the Super League in Australia was just a little side bet. It was like one of those bets at the casino where you put $1 up the top and try and win the jackpot.
Yeah, comparatively. It's kind of funny when you think of like the Super League war or lack thereof in the UK is like a sideshow to the one in the NRL. But then the one in the NRL is kind of a sideshow compared to what happened in European football with not just Sky, but like Canal Plus and other, you know, major, what's one in Italy called? The one that Berlusconi owns, Rai, I think it's called, or Medianet, something like that. But all the different countries had their own version of it where the pay TV provider basically came in, whacked up everybody's wages, and then it was kind of killed off every other sport. And if you know, you could have this conversation in French about talking about the Tour de France in the 90s, and they'll all probably say, yeah, football killed it. Or I'm sure there's niche cricket podcasts talking about, you know, the 2005 Ashes, and go, well, yeah, but we had that last time it was on free tour, and football's killed it since. Nobody watches it. So that's what everybody says who's not a football fan. And guess what football fans say? Wasn't it better in the 90s? Wasn't it better in the 80s? That's what people are like. I listened to a whole host of nostalgic football podcasts about football in the 90s, and I can't tell you how happy I am to be on the rugby league version of that.
Well, we should probably get to the game itself. We've given a lot of context to the era. How about just some opening thoughts? Andy, do you want to start?
I absolutely loved staying up watching these when I was a kid, and I was following the English game from the 94 tour, as I always talk about on the Super League pod, and I loved this game. I remember watching it, and I remember thinking, Bobby Dazzler, how good's Bobby Goulding, and who's this Robbie Paul? Is that Henry Paul's brother? And, you know, all sort of stuff, and, you know, Prescott with the super tries, and it was just so exciting, man. I loved it.
It was the first time watching it for me. I didn't watch it at the time. And so it's been hard for me to separate like the pure experience from all the wider context. And so for me, as good a game as it was, for me, the most striking thing was just the fact that it was this unseasonably warm day. You had this partying crowd in, you know, shorts and singlets, and it was just so bright and sunny. And just as an introduction to summer rugby, even though this was technically still, you know, the winter competition, like it's basically the 1995 season's Challenge Cup final. So it was in this weird bridge period. And just as an introduction to the new era of rugby league, you couldn't have imagined a more perfect day of weather and a more perfect exhibition on the field.
Well, it was 75 degrees Fahrenheit in the sun, the commentator said.
Which is like, I think that's what it was today and what's in the autumn. by the standards of Bradford, that's positively tropical. So you should understand as well, like, what Bradford were doing at the time. So before Super League, there'd been Cougar Mania in Keighley, and sort of Bradford kind of took that idea and ran with it. So Keighley famously didn't get included in the first Super League, and Bradford, who'd been terrible, well, not terrible, inconsequential previously. They hadn't been to the cup final since, well, I think since the 70s. They lost to Featherstone, I think 73, something like that. Saints even hadn't won it for 20 years as well. A lot of times the Saints had been, they've been in the final, they just got beat by Wigan, because everybody got beat by Wigan. And so for when Bradford won the semi against Leeds, Robbie Paul was unbelievable in that game, absolutely unbelievable. But he was still this like kind of unknown figure. Like this whole thing, you know, they talked through the whole game about the £10,000 for the hat trick in the cup final. Like I can remember that being a thing. Like that was a thing. And so it was like I would sit and watch this, and it was like, who is this Robbie Paul? Though, and you know, and when he's that age, I would have just been about to turn seven. Like everything is so new, and this is the first cup final I can remember. Like. So it's kind of like, this is the first time when I'm like, rugby league's amazing. This is my favourite thing. And yeah, I'm 31 now, so it's gone pretty well since. But when you look at that now, it still looks as sort of technicolor and brilliant. Like even me watching it, you know, watched rugby league, British rugby league my whole life, I still get that feeling that you get watching it the first time. But like, it looks new and it looks bright.
We should set up what actually happened in the game. So pretty crazy. So 140-32 by St. Helens in the end. 14-12 to Bradford at half time. So it was a real slow burn, because not having seen the game before, knowing the final score, I'm watching like the first like 20 minutes, and you know, you had that, like, Prescott got two tries in the first 20 minutes, didn't he? Did he score?
Yeah.
Is it the first two St. Helens tries?
Yeah, he scored the chip over and kick on.
Yeah, amazing try. Amazing try.
You know, but here's the thing. That try was as good as Mullins' one. He kicked it on the full the second time, and the commentators barely even touched on it. It was like, he plays a bit of soccer, this boy, you know, whatever.
I noticed you and I both had it in our notes, Andy, but opening kickoff... opening kickoff, St. Helens kicking to Bradford. Bradford immediately, like, kick it back to them.
I've never seen that before. I was like, what is this? What are they doing?
And then conceded a penalty.
Yeah, it's probably the worst start in the history of rugby league. But I get what he was thinking. We're going to assert our defense. But in the modern terms, they were just tackling from the 40-meter line.
Crazy. We watched the full coverage where you get the, you know, not the Brett Kenny with his hands in his pockets, but you get them seeing the, you know, the dignitaries, which I thought the brilliant rugby league name, Ian Sproke, before it turns out he's actually a Tory MP. He's the minister for sport at the time, probably not a rugby league man. But just before it, one of the things I noticed, I completely forgot, there's this guy, Chris Casely, who I guess, I don't know if you know who he is. I think he was Sam Burgess's agent. I think he lives here now. But he owned Bradford Bulls at the time. And he looks like, I've written down Bad Vegas Gambler / Country Music Awards to describe his outfit. But he was like the Consul General to the Netherlands or something. But he was the chair of Super League for a bit. He's a very sort of colourful character. I've made two pages of notes on this, and about half of them is just quotes from Ray French. So.
Me and Andy listening to Ray French, like, we just think he's great. But, I understand, like, he's quite divisive in England. It seems that, you know, not everyone loves him.
No, in my house he is. He's very much a favoured character. Like, as someone who can only do two impressions, and one of them's Jimmy Savile, like, I've had to basically stick to Ray French ever since the unpleasantness. But he's very much like I think of him as a loved character. I don't. He's not like Eddie Waring was very sort of people thought he was a caricature of that. Whereas Ray French, I guess because he'd done it as well. Like he played League and Union for England. Like he was a proper character. And like, I've met him a few times. He's a lovely man. Like one of the things you notice in the press box here is that nobody says hello to you. Whereas whenever I was like cover a grand final or something, Ray French would just start talking to you like he'd been there all the time. So he's a very nice man as well. But I've noted here as well, which I think would have been lost on you, but the Robbie Paul with his collar up the whole time.
Yeah.
Does that mean anything to you?
It means he's a douchebag.
Yeah. No, that was a thing that Eric Cantona did.
Ah,
yeah, right.
So there was an advert at the time with Eric Cantona with his collar up, and he like take, or he used to take penalties. He would put his collar up and then whack it in the net. So I think that's sort of Robbie Paul being like, I am the cool kid here, which he pretty much was.
It's a ballsy move, but then to go on and do what he did. So the hat trick of tries, the third try he scored, 14-12 at halftime. Bradford go on to get up 26-12 before St. Helens come back and, you know, get 8 points in front before Robbie Paul scores his third try, which was just like brilliant. The most beautiful individual try maybe since Kenny in 85. And I want to talk about the comparisons to that Challenge Cup final. But for Robbie Paul to call his shot like that, put the collar up and put on an exhibition like that.
The funny thing is that if he hadn't scored a try, I think, in the cup before that day, but having watched the semi-final, like, he's just as good in the semi-final, in which he absolutely runs the show. He gets criminally robbed of a try, scores a similar try to that one, and then the referee, he says he knocks it on, which he just doesn't knock it on. Now, they show it about 15 times and he hasn't knocked it on. Video ref would have let it go. But he had this thing where he just looked faster than everybody else. And it's very for me, it's interesting to watch, because if you look at my perception of this game, right, was that Robbie Paul was great, but that Bobby Goulding was actually should have been man of the match. But when you watch that second half, and even when Bradford are, you know, Saints are clawing it back, Robbie Paul, still every time he gets the ball, he looks like he's going to run through everybody. I don't know if this is just something that was always in you know, the kids that I played with, but when you had the spin was always sort of the Robbie Paul. That was the move that he scored the second try with, which was, I don't know if that, I'm sure it existed prior, but that was the thing about, that was what Robbie Paul did. Like, that was his move. And then the other sort of just flip side of that, which I think we'll probably mention, is Nathan Graham's inability to catch the ball off a kick. Mm. Like, somebody kicking the ball up in the air was, you know, something he'd never come across before. And his sort of position is a tragic figure in this, where basically all three tries that result in Saints clawing back the deficit are all basically the same try.
How did his career pan out after that? Did he
not brilliantly? Although there is an interesting coda to it at the end, which is that at the start of the pandemic, I think he was the coach of Scotland. He may still be the coach of Scotland. I think John Duffy is the league coach of Scotland now. He was the coach of Scotland. He played for Dewsbury. His top level career didn't really go anywhere for obvious reasons. But he was working as like a frontline health worker during the pandemic whilst being Nathan Graham. There were stories about it. You can dig out stories about it from last year. And I was like, wow, that's what Nathan Graham does now. On the less happy side, I did also find out what Villa Matautia does now, which is one of the two. Which, incidentally, there is only, I think, two Australians playing this game. Saints don't have a single Australian, which is an amazing thing to think of British Rugby League with no Australians. They've got Villa Matautia and Apollo Perolini. Matautia still lives in St. Helens, and last I heard of him was appearing in court for battering a 15-year-old.
Oh, God.
keeping the rugby league tradition alive. Good.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about the actual style of the game, because Mick's always talking about bright football, and I subscribe to his love for that. And it was definitely bright football, but it's so unstructured and so frenetic. I loved it, and it's such a shame that the toothpaste's out of the tube now, because I'd love to go back to that as opposed to the structured play.
You know, there's a bit in the second half where Ray French said, you know, the hook of the game is what, 40-32? And then it comes up on screen that's been like 36 errors or something.
Mm.
And Ray French says, well, it's a lot of errors, but let's think it's probably made the game better or something along those lines. You know, because like, every time they got the ball, it was immediately, how can we try and score from this play?
Yeah.
There's not many benign hit-ups in this game.
I had it in my notes. I noticed they did a flash of the errors after 10 minutes. After 10 minutes, Bradford had made 4 errors. Like, if a team did that in an NRL game now, like, you know, they'd be crucified. This is a good place to introduce and compare the 85 Challenge Cup, I think, because it was very similar in the way that it was so freewheeling and people were just making these ridiculous decisions that, you know, half the time wouldn't come off. They'd be, you know, throwing a ball to no one into touch, running blind and getting bundled out and just, you know, throwing intercepts. And it was just accepted as, well, you know, you do that. And then sometimes it doesn't come off, but sometimes you get a brilliant attacking move out of it. And I think it's something that has really been lost, you know, on in both hemispheres of rugby league.
Yeah. Do you know, I went and watched successive Champions League Challenge Cup finals to try and work out when it starts to look like Rugby League Today. Just watching random games picked out, not just Challenge Cup finals, actually, but I watched in a part of a segment I'm going to call Was Robbie Paul Actually That Good? where I watched the 2002 World Cup Challenge against Newcastle. And so Newcastle's got like Joey John, Danny Badiris, like it's a pretty fucking good team. They just won the Premiership. And Robbie Paul ran the show. First four tries of the game, two of them he scores and two of them he lays on. But that looks like that 2002. It was Vinicolo's first game. I remember going to it and being so excited to see Lazio Vinicolo. More excited than seeing fucking Andrew John. Like, seems strange. Especially when he later played for Warrington and we like drove specifically to watch Andrew Johns play. I guess the myth had sort of risen by 2002 to my 13-year-old brain. Like Vinicolo was the thing.
The volcano.
Yeah, and he scores this like pretty generic running try, and everyone's like, "Oh my lord, what is this man?
Look at the size of him!
Look at the size of him!" But he's a winger. But yeah, by that stage, it starts to look structured. Still a bit like all over the place, and I guess that's probably Australia has, you know, come into it a little bit more because I feel like down at lower level English rugby league that continued for ages. Like, I mean, we can talk about Bobby Gilding's time coaching Rochdale, which was very much in that. That was the order of the day, shall we say. But he, there's some interesting sort of asides. I thought, I mean, we should probably talk about the coaches as well, right? Because this is a legend of this podcast and a legend of rugby league.
Well, rumour has it that Sean McRae moved to England under the behest of his wife to escape a certain gentleman caller from Newcastle.
I wonder if he had a St. Helens equivalent, like calling up his wife to ask if Kieran Cunningham was going to be playing.
It was Mike.
No, I can tell you some of my embarrassing rugby league stories, actually, from the 1995 Challenge Cup semi-final, when I was literally 5 years old, and it's sort of your own rugby league episode of Kids Say the Funniest Things. Oldham lost, and we very much wanted Oldham to win. And after the game, like in the sort of bar, it was at Huddersfield Stadium. In the bar, my dad was like, "This is blah blah blah." He refereed the game, and my 5 year old went, "Oh, my dad thinks you're an idiot."
It wouldn't be the first time he said that.
No, it's probably not the 100th time he said it today, and probably the previous 99 of them was my dad screaming at him.
Very cute. But I tell you what's funny, like, it goes to show the importance of what town you're from in the north of England. They were saying, and there's Stuart Cummings, he's from Widnes. Like, have you ever heard an Australian referee, like, where he's from?
Yeah, I can't believe they flashed it up on the screen where the ref was from.
Yeah.
There's actually, speaking of indie bands, there's a band called Half Man, Half Biscuit, who I can't remember what town it is, but they're a very sort of lyrically dense, shall we say, band. Obscurantist might be the word, but they have a bit about. A line about some town being the sort of town that referees come from. Like, Paul, I always think of one of the referees, Graham Paul, is from the town of Tring. And no, I have no idea where Tring is. I don't know anything about it, but that's where Graham Paul is from.
That's really funny.
The last time we saw Sean McRae, he was on the field in the 94 grand final wearing a pair of King G's and a pastel yellow polo. So, looking him in his suit, the Challenge Cup final, he looked $1 million. He's cleaned up his act.
He's an interesting character. My dad actually knows both of the coaches in this, right? For some reason, he knows Sean McRae. I asked him about this because I knew that he knew him, right? And I said, "Why do you know Sean McRae?" My mum, ironically, I'm sure Sean McRae doesn't listen to this, so he long would have turned up. My mum used to call him Bullfrog, not like Peter Moore, but like because she thought he looked like a frog. A pig frog, in fairness. But so when he was on the Kangaroo tour, I don't know if it was the 90 or the 94 one, like, because they were based in Manchester, my dad was like a Manchester development officer. His job was like helping them out. So obviously his go-to was Sean McRae. So he just got on with him, blah, blah, blah. And then Brian Smith, he knew really well, like really well. So Brian Smith, my first childhood teddy was called Brian Smith. My brother's was called Kevin Tamati. So Brian Smith was a school teacher in St. George, James Cook High School in St. George. And they played a tour against the school that my dad worked at in St. Helens, where Matt Callan, who plays in this game, he went to that school. He's now the coach of Rochdale Arnott. So my dad just knew him as like his equivalent who did the same job, but on the other side of the world.
Mm.
I mean, I'd much rather do it in St. George and St. Helens, put it that way. But so they, you know, my dad written like knew Brian Smith. He was sort of, Brian Smith was the mentor to lots of coaches in the UK, like Steve Deacon, his brother Peter Deacon was the, you know, the head honcho at Bradford. Steve Deacon coached a million clubs in the UK, mostly the second division. I don't know if he ever coached him in Super League. He was the first coach of the Catalans before they got into Super League. So I interviewed him last year actually for a podcast series, and he just went on for 20 minutes about how good Brian Smith was and how his coaching methods were revolutionary and no one had ever seen anything like it, blah, blah, blah. So this is what, you know, Brian Smith had gone from, he was all full FC coach 89, 90, then obviously gone back to, was he St. George in the early 90s? Yeah. And then came back to Bradford again, lost the final. But he was very much like seen as being the future, you know, he was doing very different stuff to everybody else. I would imagine Sean McRae's background being as sort of a physical trainer would also have put him into that bracket as well. Because I can imagine there wasn't much physical training going on prior in St. Helens. But there was this kind of style of fitness, like, and if you look at what happened, so Sean McRae wins the title that year, wins the Challenge Cup. Then you get the next year, Bradford under Matthew Elliott, they go, I think they won 20 games unbeaten. They'd won the league before they lost the game. So they really did. If you look at these two teams, you've had 8 years of Wigan winning everything. And then I think seven of the next eight premierships are won by Bradford or Saints. So this is very much the two teams who become the Super League era before, kind of in the mid-2000s, Leeds and Wigan come back in a little bit. Well, Saints have pretty much stayed at the top the whole time. But they're, you know, these two are going to be the next big thing. And when you watch it in this, the hindsight that we have now, that's what it looks like.
And you mentioned that Bradford had come from, you know, not being a very successful club to, you know, here they are at Wembley. So do you put a lot of that on Brian Smith?
I mean, there's the whole holistic thing about it. Like, I used to go to Bradford, not every game, but a lot of games in that time period. And the experience was totally different. Like, you can't overstate how much they changed what rugby league was meant to be. Like, this was, it's funny actually, because their stadium is literally a big hole in the ground. Like, it's a massive natural crater. So it wasn't as if they had much to work with.
How appealing.
It is literally, it was three sides of uncovered, plus it still had a speedway track around it. And the ball would often hold up. There was a camber for the speedway track. So it wasn't good facilities. Like, you couldn't see it from a distance because it went down. Like, you had the floodlights, and you know, when you walked there, you had to park on the street and walk across a load of footy fields to get there. So if it had been raining, like, forget about it. It didn't have women's toilets. Like, it was a shithole. But they made it into an experience because they had the pre-match. They had, like, I remember they would do like Blues Brothers nights, and if you came dressed as the Blues Brothers, you got in for free, and they'd have like a tribute band on and stuff like that. It sounds really tinpot now, but at the time it was like, wow. And I've actually included in our notes a link to the Saints' attempt at this, which is called the Saints Experience, which basically meant they made a happy hardcore remix of Owen the Saints and put some fairy lights around the, around like the pillars at Knowsley Road. I remember going and it being a big thing, you know, and it was like a bag of shite. Although in a very Rugby League Digest way, the article I linked from the St. Helens Star, probably 80% of it is about the standards of the toilets. So
yeah. that was it was all about the Saints experience, and it was literally just about improvements to the toilet facilities.
I went there, they didn't improve. I don't think they noticeably improved.
How funny is rugby league?
But yeah, it must have been, right? And if you look at, so you look at the players on display here, right, you've got, I think of, like, you know, the Saints teams who went on to win World Cup challenges. You've got Joints playing, New Love's playing, Kerry Cunningham's 19. You get, then you, on the other side, you get Robbie Paul. You've got James Lowe's, who's actually cup tied. So James Lowe's was kind of my favourite player as a kid. He was an unbelievable hooker. He just moved from Leeds, so he couldn't play because he'd already played in the early rounds of the cup. And you, I think you can tell they don't really have a hooker. That's probably why they're so just fucking throw it anywhere. Nobody's telling them where to go. But so the kernel of that team is there, and you look at, I think at the time, Sculthorpe might have been at Warrington, so he was not long before coming over. Goulding was eventually moved on when Sean Long came in, and obviously Sean Long went on to be the sort of stalwart leader of that team for years and years and years, and Goulding went off the rails, became a maniac. But we should talk a bit about Bobby Goulding, right? Because he is an absolute hero, and I can assure you, every kid that played rugby league, like every team he played from St. Helens, Wigan, Widnes, blah, blah, had their number 7 had that haircut, like the reverse mullet almost, where he's got like the little sticky up bit at the front. But he. That was him. Like, he was either completely brilliant or completely mental. Like, you look at his, I know the season after he got suspended for about 10 weeks in the season, they still picked him for Great Britain because they were like, if someone's going to do it, it'll probably be him. Like, he, when he was the coach of Rochdale in the early 2000s, he played some of the best individual performances. Like, Rochdale were not a particularly good team, and we turned over. Remember, we beat Castleford 17-16, in which he was, I'd say, comfortably the best individual performance I've ever seen, and he still got thinned in for fighting. Like, and he was like trying to fight the crowd. Like, he was off. I remember when I worked at the rugby league, one of my jobs, I would get sent to go and get the disciplinary files for the match review panel. Back before there was anything was computerized, you had to go and get files out of the attic. And I found Bobby Goulding's disciplinary file, and it was huge. We were convinced he was on something. I'm sure, I don't want to libel Bobby Goulding because he's a very angry man. But I'm told he's a very nice man, but he's always come across as quite a man with a fuse. But yeah, he was on his day absolutely unplayable. And like, this was one of his days when he was just chest out, littlest guy in the field, but just did not give a shit. I think of him, maybe that's because of the recent death of Toddy Radonikis, but like, that's the mold of character that he was. He was like a tiny number 7, but also a hard man.
To me, he had the time of a Cliffy Lyons or a Jason Smith with the ball. His ball playing was just a thing of beauty.
Yeah, definitely. And he is, without him, that team, there's nothing. Like Carl Hammond, who was a great player. The try that put Saints in front, since Danny Arnold scores. And Nathan Graham with a dummy that Nathan Graham's paying back in after that one. He gets sent so far. So he was a real mercurial player as well. But Bobby Goulding was the one telling everybody where to stand, where to go, and just leading everything sort of by example and by sort of first force of personality at the same time.
And this kind of leads you back to 85 as well. We mentioned the, you know, Stirling and Kenny comparison. You had Goulding and Robbie Paul here. And obviously with a different result than what we saw in 85. Do you agree with the Lance Todd decision? So Robbie Paul got it in the end with his 3 tries, but Bobby Goulding won the game for St. Helens.
Before I watched the game through, I remember at the time, obviously, first hat-trick at Wembley, it seems completely obvious that he wins it. And then in the intervening 25 years, I thought actually probably Bobby Goulding was better. But then having watched it again today, like, that is the quintessential, like, Lance Todd trophy win in a losing performance. Like, he is by far Bradford's best player. Like, and if it hadn't have been for him, they would have got absolutely, you know, battered. And he's so much better than anybody else on Bradford's team. Even that's not to say that Bradford played pretty badly, but like, he was so much better. And I think there's a crucial thing, which I've really only realised today. The way they do the Lance Todd trophy is it's a vote in the press box. And I know I have voted in the Lance Todd trophy previously. And at the time they would have took the vote, he just scored that try and Bradford were 32-30 to Saints.
Yeah.
And then obviously the goal was, they might have even been winning. And sometimes they would do it 20 minutes from the end. So he's just scored that try and everyone's gone, well, it's got to be Robbie Paul.
Yeah.
There you go. So I think had it been done after the game, it might have been different. I think like in the 2005...
Well, it's Australian tradition as well, but it's got in the Northern Hemisphere. Why can't they wait till the end of the effing game to give the man in the match?
How long does it take to tally like 20 votes and get, you know, relay the news down to the prezzo?
It's insane.
Yeah. But the thing is as well, I don't know if it has the Clive Churchill medal doesn't really have the same cachet, but like in the Lancer Trophy, it's like the biggest betting market. So like everybody wants to bet on it. So you can guarantee that half of the press box has probably got a tenner on someone to win it. Like, it's the sort of thing that if someone didn't watch rugby league all the time but would watch like big games, they would text you saying, who should I bet on for Landstad? Like, that's the bet that you do. And it's a sign of Southern bookies is that they never offer a man of the match market. And you're like, that's what everybody wants to bet on. And you just wouldn't, because they don't do it all the time. You'd be like, well, these people don't know what they're on about. Like, the amount of times I've been in the bookies at Euston Station trying to put on my bets, and they go, oh, sorry, we don't do a man of the match market. And you're like, fuck off. Wembley Stadium bookies didn't do it for a long time, and I think enough people complained that they started doing it.
Well, I've got a funny story about the bookies there. When I lived there in 2000 to 2002, I started gambling as my addiction wants on Super League, and the Southern bookies, you had to write the tickets out in pencil and a carbon copy thing, and they didn't know about rugby league, the old ducks at the Ladbrokes. So I was getting the prices for the line, like minus 12 and a half or whatever, but just head to head. And I was cleaning up there for a few weeks until they caught up. Because I didn't know about rugby league.
Yeah, this is, there's a couple of other, like, so the thing is, it's hard to say with the Bobby Gilner thing, like, having watched it again, like, he is brilliant. But the reason that I think that I thought he'd been even better than he was because he set up all those tries. But really, his great tactical innovation of that thing of kicking the ball really high in the air because his fullback is an incompetent and just doing it repeatedly. I don't know how big a tactical innovation that actually is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in hindsight, just, yeah, it's not exactly rocket science. Like, the guy keeps fucking up, to just keep doing it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I think it also goes back to, you know, the many discussions Andy and I have had about Kenny and Sterling. Just the fact that Kenny is so much better to watch, that, you know, Sterling kind of like goes in the shadow a bit, despite him, you know, have achieved so much more and being probably the all-round better player. As good as Bobby Goulding was in that game, it's Robbie Paul that I've got my eyes on. You know, I want to see those big plays, and that's kind of what I'm watching for.
Yeah, and you know, I thought of this before, right? So I think Robbie Paul is probably the last great Kiwi who never played in Australia.
Yeah.
So you think of before that, I actually went and looked, the Leeds team who played in the final the year before had, I think, four or five Kiwis, of which only Kevin Iroh had played like a substantial amount of ARL. So you have like Asani from Marlowe's there, Richie Blackmore's there. Who are the other ones? One of the Manns, George Mann or Dwayne Mann, I think they're George Mann, maybe. And there's loads of them. They never played in, you know, never had substantial careers. The same as, I know it's been mentioned on this podcast before about Tuer and Nicow, and it's like, is he actually, as you would say, fair dinkum? Like, is he actually any good? And Robbie Paul, I guess Tommy Lulu'i still has it a little bit, where like he'll still get picked for New Zealand from time to time. Or certainly was he played in the last World Cup, and he was the only player they had who played in Super League. Or Ben Murdoch-Matilla now, and you're like, wow, Super League, he must be shit. And then he turns up and actually, no, this guy's pretty good. And like Robbie Paul was the last one who was like, is he, like, he never played in Australia, and yet everybody pretty much universally accepted that this guy was shit hot. Like,
yeah, we did. But I used to love when I had the players we didn't see over here, like Inga Tuwegimala and guys like that, that you'd see just in Super League, or just in England, I mean. And that was exciting for us, you know, getting the open rugby magazine and going, oh, who's this, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that team, the year before, the Wigan team would have had Tuwegimala and like Fran Obotiko.
I loved him.
Do you know, I thought when I was a kid, I thought Fran Obotiko was a Maori name. He sounds like he's Croatian.
But like, he was the first guy to have the ball leaning forward on his goal kicks.
This is something I noticed in this game, right? This is a bit like proper old man stuff, you know. there's a thing in England about, like, when did dog shit stop being white? Like, when did they stop kicking off sand? Like, all the kicks in this are off sand.
Well, I tell you what, they weren't exactly kicks, the first three from Bobby Goulding. They were disgraces.
Yeah, it's amazing that, like, and even though he's just had this amazing game, that's the first thing that they mentioned to him in the interview as well. You missed a few kicks, Bobby. Did you notice, you know, he goes and gets his kid at the end?
I love that part about it, yeah.
Do you know that kid is?
It's his son, right, that plays at North Queensland, right?
Yeah, he played for Newtown. And I only realised that, literally watching the series, like, oh, that must be Bobby Goulding Jr., age three. He played at Newtown, played at Widnes, I think.
Well, I thought that was beautiful because they took him up to get the trophy and he's so excited. And it must be like you with your father going to the Challenge Cup and that. But then they had the comparison with John Hamer's son, daughter, looking really, really stern and pouting.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, like, oh, she looks disappointed. It's all right, love, or something like that.
The commentators are really weird because I think it's the Australian bloke who looks like they've just gone central casting Australian. Like, we just needed a guy with the strongest Australian accent we can find, which I think is Steve Sims.
Well, he sounded like a bloke from down the pub. Like, it was.
Yeah. he vacillated between, this is on the BBC, and there might be a lot of people who don't know rugby league watching, so I'm going to explain really obvious things in really minute detail to, like, wildly off the mark, like, pieces of analysis. Like, yeah. Well, they've done well. They've tried to pass the ball backwards there. that kind of level. I also quite enjoyed that because Bradford Bulls had only just become Bradford Bulls, whenever they show the replay, it would say St Helens and Bradford B, as if it was like Cardi B's Yorkshire cousin, Bradford.
I didn't know why they had Bradford B. It was because they couldn't fit it in, right?
Yeah, they must have not been out of fit. The graphics department probably did that morning. Said, what are we going to do? Oh, do we just go the Bulls? Do we just go Bradford? Let's go Bradford B, just to make sure it's not the other Bradford.
Well, it's going to degenerate into more nostalgia, but I was looking at the graphics thinking, how do we accept these? I still think they were shit hot, those graphics.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you've already slagged Australian Rugby League on the Mega Drive on this podcast. I played last year, and the idea that you could play as Oldham and Workington on the Mega Drive was unbelievable.
Yeah. I used to love it too.
But we had our own version of that, incidentally, on the PC, where every player looked like Paul Broadbent. I've tried to find an emulator for it, but you can't play it anymore. And it had Eddie and Steve up doing the commentary, and it was, he's got a smile as wide as Christmas Day. So I don't think even in the annals of Steve O's shit commentary he's ever actually said.
I'm obviously, you know, steeped in this period of history at the moment. And you mentioned the Bradford Bulls thing and all the other teams making that same change. You can't really underestimate how big a change that is. You know, you got like, you know, Warrington of the Wire, and now suddenly like they're the Wolves, and just these really seemingly artificial names being brought into it. Whereas in Australia, like we kind of like always had those other names.
But it's strange though, because Rochdale Hornets have been Rochdale Hornets since forever.
Like, yeah.
It's not completely new. Like you have, obviously you had like, you know, Wigan Warriors and Cats. I think Cass Tigers have been Cass Tigers since 1926. Like, I don't think some Cass Tigers fan will definitely send you a tweet about that. Tweet it to me, I'll tell you to fuck off. But you know, like, so you had, I mean, I always think of Halifax Blue Sox was the most cringeworthy one.
Yeah.
Oh, but they're now terrible. Halifax, they've just become Halifax Panthers now. But Bradford Bulls seems to work. And it took me years to realize they just basically nicked the Chicago Bulls.
Logo. Yeah.
But like Bradford, there is probably a symbolic moment you can pull out from going from being Bradford Northern to being Bradford Bulls. Like, what's our brand going to be? Are we going to be Northern or are we going to be something else?
I've got to say, like, I love all that stuff like The Wire and stuff like that. But, you know, if you want to go out of the Northern England area, you got to go a bit more American at some point. Like, the fact that they're The Wire and you've got to deduce who that is as a foreign fan.
Yeah. It's weird now because you think of, if you go to grounds, like people still call like Widnes the Chemics, like you still hear that. Or Leeds are the Liners, not the,
yeah.
You know, people say Rhinos as well. Like it's kind of when you go to the Roosters, like you still hear, you still have, you know, East, like you know, they still does exist, and it's kind of, I kind of like the idea now that you've got sort of the official one, but you haven't, you still have the heritage one as well. It's not lost. Good. Like, I don't think anyone's calling Lee the Lobby Gobblers anymore, but that's, you know.
Just a few random things. I wanted to talk about Graham Bradley. Love Graham Bradley. Just followed Brian Smith to Bradford from St George. And he actually kind of became somewhat of a Bradford legend. It seems like he's quite revered by Bradford fans.
Yeah, he was a great player. He was way too tall to be a standoff. Like, he I remember him being like a properly good player, and he stayed with them for a couple of years, really, until Henry Paul came in. I actually think maybe it was because when they were really, really good around like the 2000 kind of era, he'd gone by then, and they had the Henry, Robbie, and then Paul Deacon. So Paul Deacon basically became the Bobby Goulding style player, the very much hand on the tiller kind of guy. And they were a brilliant combination. But yeah, Bradley, I think they had some real ropey Australians at the time, though. And they actually, if you look at the players they had later, they had way more New Zealanders, you know, Joe Bangana. And Tevita Vaikoa, Tevita Vaikoa Tongan, but Tevita Vaikoa, Leslie Vinacolo, like people like that, they had this, that was their shtick, was that they had like the big four props. So you had, I think it was Field and Peacock, Anderson, Vangana, and then, no, that was what they did. Big Islander guys, like in terms of, you know, Wigan went out and signed, you know, Trent Barrett and people like that, and that wasn't really the Bradford way up until, I guess, they got Matt Orford at some point, was probably the only one you could think. I mean, we're going, you'd be going forward a lot there. I'm trying to think, was the interesting thing as well, speaking of the on the Saints team, right? I forgot Tommy Martin goes off injured in this game, because I thought Tommy Martin played brilliantly. So he actually was the season after, he basically was the best player on the field. I don't think he won the last trophy, but he was very, very good. They basically had a rematch in the same final, which was also like a really good game. It's not as good as this one, but still a really good game. 30-22 or something like that. Saints won again. But Tommy Martin was brilliant that year, and Kyle Hammond as well. And I, in my head, Tommy Martin had been brilliant in this game. But then I was, half an hour and he's limping off. I'm going, well, is it going to be some sort of Lazarus-like comeback from Tommy Martin? But I thought it was worth sharing. Right? So I was listening to your podcast this week talking about, you know, the music in Central Park.
Yeah.
Right. So I rang my dad up and was like, do you remember that? And he never remembered it. But my theory is that he might not have known it was the clown music.
Yeah.
When he heard it. And he was just saying, that's the Wigan music. And now it's the clown music. But Tommy Martin scored the last try at Central Park. I went when they shut the ground down, in which you can watch the, there's no highlights of the game on YouTube, certainly that I could find. If you find them, anyone on the internet, please do send them to me. But he scored last try. There's a brilliant VT that Sky did beforehand, in which they interview all the old boys. It's like the steward who's been there for 50 years. And it's like something out of a Peter Kay sketch, right? But they talk to Sean Edwards, who looks like he's just got out of prison, like, to describe his outfit. And they go, what's your first memory of Central Park? And he says, trying to sneak in without paying.
It's the ultimate crim face.
that is his face. He's like Sean Edwards in the prison yard. He's in like a singlet, and he looks. Do you think how was that man going out with Heather Small, like, in the height of the fame?
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. But he should be in
Black Grape or the Mondays or something.
Yeah. He just needs like a black leather baseball cap on backwards. But in that game, right, a little bit off topic, but I'm sure he'll allow it because it's just really fucking rugby league story. So it was Wigan Saints, the last game at Central Park. Wigan won, but Tommy Martin scored the last try. But about 2 minutes from the end, we were in like the main stand with all the old like clappy wooden seats. And they basically said, you know, have you ever seen the film 24 Hour Party People?
Love it.
Yeah. You know, where Tony Wilson says, you know, to the best of your abilities, loot. Yeah, and they basically said that on the tannoy. Like, if you want to take anything home, it's video Tesco next week, so just take what you want. And people pulled out like crowbars and like smashing up the stage. And we brought a seat home to my mate. So my mate somewhere in Rochdale, guy I played footy with as a kid, has got a Central Park chair that we just fucking nicked. Wow. And, well, I guess nicked, they let you have it, but people like smashed the stadium apart live, like live on Sky.
Well, I was going to say, Mike, when you said you're talking to the old steward being there for 50 years, it reminded me of 24-hour party people when he talks to the guy who's 100 years old and he goes, what do you remember about that time? And he goes, very little. Very little.
That's basically what this book does. He goes, well, I used to do the scoreboard back when they had an old scoreboard. Of course, I had an onion tied to my belt. That was the style at the time.
I'm sure they did all right out of the sale and all, and maybe you're in a better place since. But there's just something so English rugby league about Wigan selling their stadium to Tesco's.
Well, Rochdale Hornets did. Rochdale Hornets is a Morrison's. And I actually met, so funny, I was at Para a couple of weeks ago, and my dad texted me saying, are you at Para? I said, yeah. And he goes, oh, Aaron's there. So Aaron's this guy, Aaron Sawyer, who played like reserve grade in Sydney. He never made the Winfield Cup. But he scored the last try at Rochdale Hornets, his ground. Mm. And so he used to live in my house. He was like our lodger when I was a kid. So I hadn't seen him since I was about four. I literally wouldn't, you know, he remembered me more than I remembered him. Anyway, he was in the hospitality. And so my dad was like, I was in, you know, with the punters. And my dad's like, I'll go see this guy. So we go meet him up outside. I think he'd been on the drink for a bit, but he was a lovely man. But he has this like plaque now, which is in the Morrison supermarket. It's like, this is where the last try at the Athletics Ground.
Oh, wow.
By Aaron Sawyer. And it's like between like the meat and the fish. I think I've not been to the Central Park. I've not been to the Central Park Tesco's, but I hope they also have that. Says Tommy Martin, God here. And the cereals on the next aisle, like.
Well, Michael, can we ask Mike about the pizza deal? I mean, we only have dribs and drabs come through here about the pizza sponsorship for Super League.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Can we break it down for the listeners?
Yeah, it's a bit of look. It's a difficult game to sell, right? And one of the things that if you could read back my column for like 2 years ago, like one of the things that I've always written about is like you get the audience that your advertisers match your audience, right? And you can't like, I mean, we have this problem with the pokies here, like always, you know, Super League famously turned down money from a bookies 1 year and ended up with Eddie Stobart Truckers as like sponsoring the league for now. So it's not, you know, it's something we've always struggled with. Like, and I kind of understand why, like, that was better than now, when that was basically what was on the table. So I know, like, a couple of times where in the past, you look at who's sponsored. You have the Betfred Super League now, you've had the Ladbrokes Challenge Cup, like, all of these, like, Tetley's Bitter. Well, at the time that this was, you had the Silk Cup Challenge Cup bags, mm-hmm. and then the Stones Bitter Championship, Stones, which was a bitter.
I remember trying John Smith's bitter and going, this is the sponsor? Jesus.
Hey, Stone's Bitter is great, though. Stone's Bitter was great, right? Because if you wanted to go to a house party and be confident that nobody would steal your cans, Stone's Bitter was the one to bring. I used to joke, my mum's got a picture of her. I'm a twin, right? And so she's heavily pregnant with twins. And the only shirt she could find that fit was this massive promotional Stone's Bitter one that my dad had. Just like Stone's Bitter Championship 1989. And so I was like, well, I was incubated in that. So I've maintained a taste of Stone's Bitter ever since. It's but that's what, you know, when you look at rugby league on the telly, like, and the guy being interviewed has got mushy peas behind him, like, that's, it says something about the product, right? So you either have to accept that that's the product you have and take the money and be happy with it, or you have to say, right, we're going to have more blue chip sponsors. So then you've got to convince them to join up.
But how did it go from Gillette and stuff like that? I mean, surely there's washing powder being used in the north of England.
Yeah, exactly. And this is one of the failings that we've historically had, is like a lot of people, it's the same as rugby league everywhere, really. Like, you end up with lots of people who end up being quite myopic, and people who historically have lacked expertise, because most people who have expertise in England end up working in London. Yeah. So you either go down and pay like London prices and stuff, or you end up with what you have. Now, I think it's getting better. Like, they've engaged people who are better than previously. But, you know, it's just, I remember Paul Scunthorpe did a lot of ads for Gillette, right? And it was like, oh my Lord, they've got a rugby league player. Like, and he was a sort of photogenic and good kind of person who could pull it off. But like, you wonder, like, is Sam Burgess or whatever, who would he have been that? It's hard to say, really. And I sort of wonder whether that is kind of ultimately the goal for rugby league, is do you want your person to be that? I don't know that we do. Like, I'd like to think that we can create a better product than that, that sells itself in a different way, that's kind of authentic to what we are. And that's the selling point. You know,
I don't care what it is, as long as there's some cash money rolling in to grow the game. But I mean, yeah, it just seems like it's barter deals is not the go.
No, well, yeah, they don't get any money for it. So obviously that's a very bad example of it. But I kind of understand the bind that they were in. Like, I know I'm a Scottish football fan, right? So I'm acutely aware that Scottish football has exactly the same problems, and it has exactly the same demographics. Like, I've written extensively in the past about that the best way that rugby league should compare itself in England is not to the NRL or to rugby union, but to Scottish football. And that Scottish football shouldn't compare itself to the Premier League, it should compare itself to rugby league. Mm-hmm. And like, there's pros and cons there, because they're basically dealing in essentially a niche, authentic, analog product that exists in an environment predominantly made up of white poor men. Like, so what do you end up with? Bookies and bookies and beer.
You raise a very interesting point there, mate, because the Southern fairies like to think that we're all violent thugs, right? You know, so why would you want your product associated with that? But the problem is, violent thugs are so effective as rugby league players. So
yeah, like, yeah.
You can't get away from it.
But this is the thing as well. Like, one of the best arguments in favour of the international game, I just wish somebody at the NRL would listen to, is that the best advertising money is in the National Rugby League, and it comes from a key demographic that rugby league does not touch at all. I don't think in Australia or in England. Like, the higher, you know, the best and most expensive advertising you can sell is to the most wealthy people, and we just do not touch that. Like, we are KFC or Mushy P. Like, every single try that goes to the video ref bunker thing here is a massive KFC advert. Like, wasn't that a rumor last season that they were going to the bunker more often so that KFC could get more screen time?
Yeah. I mean, it's so not even a rumor. Bill Harrigan talked about that the first season of English Super League when he was reffing there, that they would ask him to go to the video ref more for the sponsor.
So, I mean, the advertising, that's kind of a problem. Like, I once counted, watching Celtic against the Burnian, that all the rotating ads on the video ad board were all bookies, and they were sponsored by two bookies, and behind the goal was Gamblers Anonymous. Mm-hmm. So, like, this is the audience that they're in. Like, how do you break out of that? Because ultimately, as was the case with the Winfield Cup, like, until it gets banned, they're going to be the people who pay the most money. So, like, are you deliberately going to turn down those people's money in favour of Mushy Peas? Or, like, are you going to try and find something, like, a different way of doing things? And ultimately, I think the best way that the best brands have dealt with this has been a third way, being like, we're just not going to play by your rules anymore. We're going to do it in an entirely different, I hate the word disrupt, but disruptive way, where you try and do something else with it. Whether that's, like, uncouple themselves from Sky by selling content themselves on their own terms, or I don't know. I mean, I've got 100 different ideas that we've done need to waste your time with, but it's a great mind to me think about this as well.
Like, if you take blood money, it's a slippery slope from a 45 degree angle to a straight drop in about 1 week. So
yeah,
I mean, it's over now for both comps.
Gambling. Yeah. Well, we've gone 25 years into the future from where we started. So let's finish it off by I want you, Mike, to help us set up our coming chapter. And if you could just maybe give us your idea of the tale that this Challenge Cup final had, and whether you think it made a significant impact to Super League in the early years.
So I think in the grand scheme of things, this is just a good symbol of what the difference between Super League and previous was. So if you looked at this game compared to even the Challenge Cup final the year before, where it was Wigan whacking Leeds, like, it was like Wigan with the Globetrotters and everybody else was the Generals. And now basically the Generals have got better because of full-time professionalism. So whilst they might mention Carl Fairbanks being a dairy farmer, like, most of the players are now professionals. So you see standards raised across the world. And what you're going to see in terms of what Bradford have done as a sort of a business entity will be picked up by other clubs. That's what Leeds Rhinos did very well. St Helens eventually, Wigan eventually. Now look at them, and obviously Bradford have had massive financial trouble in the last 10 years. But Saints, Wigan, Leeds, basically new stadiums, Leeds on the same place, mostly renovated stadiums. So you see this movement now, and so like some clubs are going to take the ball and run with it, like in a way that had it not changed, I don't think they would have done. The big thing as well, which to come back to football a minute, is that you have the Taylor Report, which basically enforces after the Hillsborough disaster, certain places have to make their stadiums better. So you end up with this standard raised from the general public, like people are now used to seeing rather than standing. And what you look at Saints and at Warrington's new ground, and Salford's as well, they've enacted safe standing. So they have this, they've gone the whole way and back again, essentially. But you then can see in Bradford what's happening commercially in rugby league. You can see in St Helens what's happening in terms of the team that's going to end up dominating. Like they're probably, between them and Bradford, the dominant team of the first, certainly the first decade of Super League. Saints are still going now, being really good. So, you know, Saints, I wouldn't say they transformed themselves because they were a good club before that. Of course they were. But like, the modern incarnation of Saints is kind of born that day. That's like, this is going to be the comeback king, which is their sort of trademark. Eddie Hemmings, PM, you can never write off the Saints. This is their big first comeback that kind of sets that narrative on the field. And also just like, you look at the game being played in the summer like that. The cup final was always in the summer, or, you know, the end of August, start of May. So that's lots of cup finals. If you only watched cup finals, you'd think it was a brilliant sunny day most of the time. But obviously, that was now the start of the season, and we're going to get another 4 months of this. So you end up with that kind of, you know, this is a good example of that thing happening. And it's as simple as going watching the semi-final, which is played on a pitch that looks like it's like frozen solid in Huddersfield.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at it and you go, well, that's a game that's played in, you know, March, and this is a game that's played at the end of April. And previously, we would have then stopped playing. And now this is only us starting playing. So I think you can see the strength of the summer rugby kind of argument in this game. I don't think it needed to be made I don't think it really needs to be made anymore. Like anybody who doesn't believe in summer rugby is just, I don't understand. But they, obviously in Europe. So it's emblematic, I think, more than it is. Like, I don't think the game itself changed anything, but this is, as I put in our notes, this is summer rugby writ large. Like, this is what it means now. This is the sort of football you can play, because you can't play that football in January, even in the sort of unstructured English way. That would just be a lot more turgid, a lot more drop ball. Now it's like, oh shit, we could play this all the time if we wanted to.
This was fantastic and a really great game. I'd urge anyone who hasn't seen it, as I said at the start, please watch it. I will still put 85 slightly ahead of it. Where are you on that, Andy?
Yeah, probably, but I still love this one too.
Yeah.
85 was just spectacle. Like, 85 was like way back to the future. That was like really, really old school. This one had a foot in both camps.
And, you know, I would like to go along with you, but as an OFC fan, I'll have to be reminded that OFC lost in 1985. And so I actually should say 2005 when all won in 1-1 is actually the greatest final ever. But when you get the Super League war moves on to 2005, you can call me back up again and we'll talk about how I sat next to Lesnar Wayne Collier. That's fine.
But Mike, thanks so much for joining us. This has been a fantastic chat. And we're really pumped to see what you've got next. So you've had some great articles over the last couple of months. So I'm keen to see what you've got in store for the rest of the NRL season.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have no plans, but I kind of just go and turn up and then see what comes to me. So could all be shit from that one, you know.
Everyone can follow you on Twitter. It's at Mike Mehal Wood, M-E-E-H-A-L-L Wood.
Yeah, tag me in things. Send me things. Tell me about how you want to bring out North Sydney Bears. A lot of people do that.
Well, the Forbes link's here as well, so you can go to your whole catalogue there. And Michael and I can't recommend that enough.
It's nice to hear people say that you have good ideas, because mostly I've lived abroad for nearly 10 years, most of which is in places that don't play rugby league. So mostly just been sat there watching it on a small screen, you know, at stupid times of the day. So it's been nice to know that people are. You know, seem to think I have something sensible to say. lot of people disagree.
Well, we're not two of those. So this, as I said, this has been great. Thanks so much for joining us, Mike. And we will speak to you soon.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.